Miriam Meets on RTE Radio 1 with Miriam O'Callaghan.
My guests this morning are a father and son. Professor Rishtard Mulcahy is a cardiologist, now retired, but was an important pioneer in the campaign for the prevention of heart disease in this country. His eldest son, Richard, has had a successful career in business. He featured on RT Television's The Secret Millionaire and has retained an interest in the community he visited and the network of charities and voluntary groups he encountered there. You're both very welcome.
Thank you, Mary.
Richard is your eldest child, is this correct?
Yes.
Can you remember the day he was born?
Oh, I'll never forget. I was sitting in my consulting rooms in Fitzwilliam Square, and I knew that Aileen had just been admitted to the nursing home beside me, and she was at least 24 hours in labour, and I was in high dough, is all I can say. I thought it would never finish. And I think the sense of relief when I heard that the baby had been born, I think I nearly collapsed.
With the relief?
With relief.
Of course, in those days, you didn't get in to be with your wife when she was having the baby.
Oh, no, at that time, nobody. The men were kept far away, I can tell you. They were. Yes.
So what was he like as a little baby?
Well, he was a cuddly little thing, like all my six children. But he wasn't actually cuddly that day because he looked a bit moist, wet, and rather... All I could see was that he was alive and that he was moving. But after a while, as they grew up a little bit, they all got very cuddly for a while.
Is it true? You were only married a very short period of time, Richard, and you were panicking that your wife wasn't pregnant.
Well, yeah, I remember, yes, another very interesting thing is that about 3 weeks after we got married, I realised that my wife was not pregnant, and I was devastated. I thought it's likely that we were both sterile and that we'd never have any children. It was really amazing how I reacted to that.
Probably because you were a doctor and you were expecting pregnancy after a second or something.
I think I had moments of definite instability, if not of madness at times, and that was one of them.
When you were growing up, Richard, what was your dad like? Was he strict?
My memories of Dad were that we'd see him at breakfast and that was it. So I had felt that he wasn't really around very much because he was very successful at what he was doing, very involved in his work. From a child's point of view, I never felt he was around. So therefore, strict didn't really come into it. There were moments where you'd have the traditional wait till your father comes home, which didn't really have that effect on us as kids, where a lot of families, you know, the father wasn't around, but they'd come home and there'd be war. But Dad was never, you never got that sense that Dad was going to give you a hard time.
Well, there was another element in that, you see, that children meet you a lot and know you while they're very young, but they forget about that. But as they get older and their memory is still available to them, they are by that time ignoring their father anyway. So they will naturally say he was never around. Although I agree that I was in the hospital quite a lot and travelling a lot and all the rest, but still I gave great attention to the children.
And Dad still has a very good vivid imagination.
About his attention.
Yeah, about his attention, yes.
Different memories, I suppose, for both of you, or different ideas of childhood.
Well, I think adults and children always have different ideas about each other, you know, and particularly when you're older. But the empirical evidence, as I would say, that to back it up was that Dad couldn't have achieved all he did in his career in setting up the Heart Foundation, the cardiology unit in Vincent's, all the things he achieved. If he had done that, there's no way he could have been at home. So that's my argument on that.
You're very lucky to still have your father. What date were you born?
Richard. I was born on the 13th of July, 1922. And it's very interesting because I have the front page of the Irish Times for that day. It was given to me on my 80th birthday by Mark Hedeman. At banner headlines announced the fact that Michael Collins had rejoined the army 2 weeks after the Civil War started. He'd been invited by my father to rejoin the army because of his prestige and because of the critical situation the country was in. And my father, of course, had been head of the army all that time. But the thing that rather irritated me was that I wasn't mentioned at all that day.
Your birth didn't get there.
Oh, not at all. I was very upset about that.
So in a sense, it was history repeating itself. I mean, Richard, you're saying your dad, Richard, was very, very busy when you were growing up. And you probably didn't see that much of your father, did you, since he was running the Irish army?
My father was a very gentle, domesticated person when he was at home, which was not very frequent. But he was very much different in this regard that my life was very irregular. His life was very regular. He was up early in the morning for Mass, 7 o'clock every morning. He was always home when he could get home. Unless the doll was sitting, he'd be home at 6 or 7 in the evening and he'd look in and see the kids. There were 6 of us. So we saw him frequently, but very briefly, is the way I'd put it. He was a very gentle person at home and did not interfere with the running of the house or of the garden or anything like that.
Do you remember your grandfather?
I do, yes. Yeah. He lived in Listenfield in Rathmines behind the Cahill Brewer Barracks. And Dad would be going down to visit his parents, and we'd go down, and particularly because it was 2 acres of ground, you could go out as kids and play in it. He always used to keep a Sten gun out in an old shed in his army grey coat. So we'd go down and play with that, and occasionally we'd get an opportunity to visit him in his study. There was a big old room full of papers and files and things like that. And there was always a musty smell when you went in. And he'd tolerate children, but that's all. You could sense that you know, you were in awe of him. You'd occasionally get him to tell you a story about what happened at Ashburn or, you know, during the times. But he didn't spend too much time with us. But, you know, he certainly would pose for photographs occasionally with us.
But would he talk about events that happened? I mean, a lot of men of that generation wouldn't talk about some of the, obviously, incidents they were involved in, whether it was RIC men being shot or... They didn't talk about it that much.
He was in the Dáil from 1918 up to 1961 when he retired. He never spoke politics or never spoke about the revolution to us when we were young. But from 1961 until he died in 1971, we provided him with all the paraphernalia to record his memoirs, which he did with his usual tremendous energy. So he's left something like 165 tapes. It was quite original at the time that we provided him with tape recorders and with tapes. So he really moved back and spent the last 10 years of his life talking about the revolutionary period.
Remind people, Richard, if they don't know, who Richard's father, your grandfather, was, and also your grandmother. I mean, Ryan was fascinating in her own right.
She was.
You do that.
My grandfather was the first chief of staff of the Irish Army, and when Collins was killed, he took over as chief of staff. Collins had been chief staff for 6 weeks, and then my grandfather was there, and he was Minister of Defence of the provisional government, and was there until 1924. Obviously, it was a very heated time during the army mutiny and the Civil War, which was obviously a very sad time for Ireland, and he was deeply involved in that and developed quite a reputation during the Civil War of being very tough and determined to ensure that democracy survived. So for a lot of people now in history, he's sort of been washed out of the books. But from our point of view, we've obviously been immersed in it all our lives.
And your grandmother?
It's important that when you say he had been chief of staff, he was actually head of the army from March 1918 until the end of the Civil War, except for the 6 weeks when Collins was commander-in-chief. That's important to me because the army tend to consider Collins as their great chief, but he was only actually chief for 6 weeks. Dad was chief, either political or military or both, for 6 years.
And as you say, he didn't talk a lot about it to when you were young, Richard, to yourselves.
No.
But even, I suppose, issues like the fact he developed a reputation for being tough and having, I suppose, to shoot the anti-treatyites. Did you ever ask him about that, Richard? Did he ever talk about that?
Oh, yes. After 1961, I've had a number of tape recordings with him. And I spoke, of course, immediately. What justification did he have for the shooting of four prisoners without trial? And he said that his justification was that the irregulars have, with Eamon de Valera, had recommended that they should shoot the members of the Dáil and of the Senate. And all the editors and those who were pro-treaty, he said that the democratic institutions of the state were under serious threat. He was willing to go to any terms to ensure that democracy was maintained. And he justified it on these grounds. And he finished up by saying, De Valera and Liam Lynch were responsible for that.
Your grandmother, too, was a very interesting woman, Richard. Min Ryan, wasn't she?
We would have been fearful of her. She ruled the house with an iron fist. And in those days, children should be seen and not heard. That's the way we were brought up. And
you just hid from her?
Well, it's not that you trembled in her presence. She had more of an effect on us, I think, than my grandfather, because he was very gentle. He was a very gentle person. I mean, it was just interesting, Dad, talking about his dad. But when we were kids, people used to accost us being a Mulcahy, which was amazing. You know, you're the grandson of Dirty Dick and stuff like this. And it was unbelievable to think, even in the 60s, that people would still remember the Civil War and take it out in us.
That's so interesting.
Which was very strange, you know, as kids, because you think that people, you know, would have moved on.
How did you handle that?
Well, you'd be embarrassed about it. You didn't. We didn't understand, you know, about the Civil War then. You know, I think it was about 10 or 11 the first time somebody ever said that to me. So I had no idea, you know, that, you know, what had my grandfather done? What, you know, I felt ashamed. Why should I feel ashamed? I didn't understand it. So it was strange. And then other people would say, oh, your grandfather was amazing and this and that. So it was just confusing for a child, you know, not to understand it.
I think my mother was very gentle and kind, but I warned her about my children that they were very unruly. And therefore, she put on this pose, I think. she was wise enough in her own.
Good. But look, we're going to go to our first piece of music. And the first piece of music is, your father didn't just leave an historical legacy. He left a musical legacy too, Richard, because we're going to take the Coolin. Tell me about his musical legacy in terms of the army.
He was very far-seeing in relation to the army, because he had some rather curious ideas that afterwards, in our new and settled democratic state, that the army would do all kinds of things like help in reforestation and all the rest. But he did, in November 1922, during the Civil War, he set up the Army School of Music. Very proud of that. Sent over John Larche, who was then professor of music at UCD, and Dennis McCullough, who had the music shop, sent them over to Germany, and there were something like 50 music masters of the Kaiser. They are all unemployed, and they found Fritz Brasse there, and he set up the Army School of Music, not only the pipe band, but also the brass band. And there were several bands, one in Dublin, in Athlone, in Cork. And it was a huge success. Cool. And, of course, the Army Music, Army School of Music is still a huge success.
Yeah, and still going strong. Yes. Just before we play, did either of you ever thinking of following your father and your grandfather into the Army or into politics?
No, interest. I got a sense that you couldn't do anything in politics.
I don't think he was an army man, really. He was a very good organiser. He was a very good delegator. He was a very successful backroom boy as chief of staff during the time. He let other people do the visible work. He never did anything in relation to the War of Independence and the Civil War, because he was sitting in his back room just directing, but not fighting or anything.
Did you love your father?
I never had the same sense of love for my father as I would have for a female or even for a female relative. But I had a great respect for my father. I had a great admiration for him, and I felt I had an important function in life to see that all his contribution to the state should be recognised. And he did that himself by all his paperwork after he retired.
Okay, and on that, we're going to take the Coolin, and it's played this morning for us by the RT Concert Orchestra. That was the Coolin there, your choice, Richard.
Miriam, if I could just interject there, you asked Dad about whether he loved his father. And it's interesting, because if you ask me that question, I would say I love Dad very much. And it seems to be a generational thing. They just didn't seem to have the capacity to show their feelings or emotions. I mean, one of the things that I remember as a kid is Dad never hugged us, never kissed us. Yes. And I remember, you know, when Dad left home and I really started to get to know Dad, one of the things I was determined to do was to break this ice veneer, this lack of emotions. And I was determined I was going to do this. So every time I met him, I would hug him. And he'd be very stiff at the start. And, you know, do you remember that? Yeah. And you've just felt uncomfortable about it. And I was determined. This is, you know, this is a father and son. You have to have that sort of relationship. And over the years, we broke that down, and now we'd be very affectionate. We'd always hug each other and give each other a kiss.
I don't think I ever kissed my mother until I came back from London in 1950 after 4 years of training there. And after I got to know the English families, where there were some of them very affectionate to each other at that time. But that's the only first time I've kissed my mother.
And did you ever hug your own father, Richard?
Never, no. I never owned that at all. No, never.
Where do you think that physical reticence came from in us Irish? Because we are a very affectionate people.
Well, I don't think the Irish Catholics, when I look back over the history, my father's history in the late 1800s, 1890, I think they were very much impressed by their Protestant brethren.
No, he's blaming the Protestants.
I'm talking about the society at the time. That's the society, the Victorian society, was created by the Protestants. Right. And they were not huggers either.
Okay,
cool. Yeah. And I think they were emulated by my father's and my
generation.
And his generation.
But are you grateful to Richard that he taught you how to hug him?
Absolutely. It's totally different now. And it's totally different. Even with my wife and everything, we're much closer together. Even that time, My father and mother were very gentle with each other, but they certainly didn't hug, but he'd touch her if she got a bit vexed or something. He'd touch her on the shoulder and say, "Now, Min." Mm. And she's quite down there.
You mentioned there that when your father left home, when did that happen, or what was that about?
We never really, as kids, because we were so happy in what we were doing in our lives and everything like that, we never really noticed anything significantly wrong with Mum and Dad, other than the occasional Mum had the habit of maybe not talking for a period of time, and because that was her way of dealing with her frustration. And so I remember then just literally 15 minutes before Dad left home, we were called into the study, the six of us and Mum, and Dad said he was leaving home. And I was 18 at the time, and we were just in shock. Six of us were in an absolute shock, and Dad said, "I'm leaving home," and he was gone. So it was like a bomb being just dropped in your life, and you just did not, you know, you didn't expect it. You didn't know how to react. I think there were my recollection was that Dad came in, told us he was leaving. Everybody was stunned in the study. Dad went out, left. He headed up to the hall door. I went after him. I, you know, couldn't understand this. And he went to the door. He'd obviously got the car packed at the time. Went to the hall door. I stood at the hall door. I started crying.
You actually came out into into the front, and you started crying, and that I get that feeling still when I think of it. It was the most awful moment of my life. Mm-hmm. I remember. Mm-hmm. Extraordinary thing. I was shattered when you stood there beside the car, weeping. Absolutely. I went off to Europe for 3 months, completely forgot about the whole thing.
God, that's very sad.
It was. I mean, it was just such a shock to us all. And, you know, and even though there wasn't that emotional bond that there is now, it was just it was an unbelievable moment. And Dad wasn't emotional about it. He didn't show his emotion because, again, that's probably the way he was brought up.
That, I was struck dumb.
Yeah, but it didn't come across. To me, it was my father was leaving and he didn't care.
But he clearly cared a lot.
Of course, yes, of course.
You say it was the worst moment of your life. You clearly cared deeply, but you didn't show it.
I still feel that emotion when I think of it. Yeah. And yet I'd all forgotten everything. Once I had left Ireland, and I might have been a different person completely. And then I came back after 3 months, expecting the worst. Of course, my hospital, which I didn't get. In fact, I got a wonderful welcome back from the Sisters of Charity. But the very virtually first thing that happened was Richard called to see me. And that was And another quite emotional thing for me too.
Do you remember that?
It was, I remember, absolutely remember it. It was, I suppose, it was so difficult for Mum, because Mum had come from the country. She'd married into Dad's family, who would be, you know, they were well known politically and as socially as a family. And, you know, it was a big thing for her. And then to be left with six children was traumatic for her. It was very difficult. And her natural reaction was that she was bitter about Dad leaving, as anyone would be. And to a certain extent, she was critical of Dad in front of us, which, again, is very difficult for a parent not to be when it's such a shock to the system. And I suppose my sense of justice, I don't know what it was, I just felt that, you know, it just couldn't be all Dad's fault, that there must have been a certain amount as well to do it, Mum. And as kids, you don't rationalise that, but you have a feeling about it. And I just felt terrible that Dad was isolated, and I just wanted to go and to let him know that I was there for him. And, of course, it caused a lot of problems at home, because Mum wasn't happy about that. She felt I was a traitor. I was letting her down. And as a kid, you don't think about stuff like that. You just think this is your mother and this is your father. And so I remember Dad had moved into a little mews in Lansdowne Park, and I went down, and he opened the door, and it was just, you know, it was just so wonderful to see him again, because I thought I'd never see him.
And Aileen was so devastated.
Aileen was your former wife and Richard's
was
mom.
So who's now deceased, actually. I was so sorry for her. She was devastated. But looking back over it, we were totally incompatible. It would have destroyed our individual lives if we'd had to live the rest of our lives together. And she benefited in the long run as well. I think she was a happier person some afterwards, but not for some time afterwards.
Do you remember that day, Richard, when Richard called to the door when you came back?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So, some things in your mind during even my lifetime are pinpointed, and that was one of the things that was pinpointed. Leaving him and when he came back, both pinpointed me. I remember them vividly, still in the same spots. I can almost remember the weather nearly.
And why did that mean so much to you when you opened the door and he was there?
Because leaving the children, of course, was a devastating thing for me. And of course, I was helped by that I found love elsewhere, which was a hugely important thing for me personally. But the contact with the children developed rapidly then after that. I was lucky that we had about a 2-acre house and garden. It had to be looked after. So every Saturday I turned up to look after the garden. I wasn't admitted to the house for some months, but the children started coming out to see me and joining me and all the rest. And I always brought back a present, a big bag of apples, oranges, no chocolates, no sweets, bananas, apples and oranges every Saturday. I think they looked forward to that too.
But it was probably incredibly generous, maybe, and big for a young man. How old were you when you called? Were you about 18?
I was 18, yeah.
Like, when you look back, that's a pretty extraordinary thing for a young man to do.
Richard was, in some ways, inevitable. Richard must have matured overnight. Mm. And he took over, to some extent, the leadership of the household. I mean, I have... I don't want to go into detail about him. I have a great regard for him because he does something for Louise and myself. That is, he emulates what I did with my father. He either comes to see us or rings us up every day. And that's a hugely important thing for older people. I have some criticisms about him, and may I mention them here?
Certainly.
Yeah, I think... I owe my good health and my vintage to the... One of the important reasons is I've been indulged in vigorous aerobic exercise for 50 years or more, including running marathons, cycling and everything else. I cannot get him to take exercise. I only ask him to do 1 mile a day. Go up to the top of his avenue, which is nearly half a mile, and come back on the avenue on Shanksmere, on his feet.
And he won't do it.
And do it just 6 days a week, and he won't do it. And if he wants to emulate his father in terms of health
and
vigour and of having an optimistic view of life, he would follow him on the matter of exercise.
You did give up smoking, didn't you?
I did give up smoking.
A few months ago?
A few months ago. Well, to be honest with you, I didn't start smoking until I was 23, and it was a rebellious thing, really.
Mm.
In fact, the six children. It was an interesting story that Dad was on the late, late one night. He had just launched a book and Gay was interviewing him and he was on an exercise bike. And Gay was saying, you know, you're a credit to the Irish people and the way you've got them off smoking. And there were the six kids at home and mum, and we were all smoking a cigarette, looking at Dad on the television. This was our way of rebelling. I have to say, if I had spent less time solving Dad's computer problems, I'd have more time to take exercise.
Yeah, he does.
But which brings us to our next piece of music. Nicely, I suppose, you had that difficulties in your early life, but you are now very close together, aren't you?
We would be, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we're very lucky that, you know, a lot of people don't get to know their parents till they're in their 30s or 40s, and sometimes people, you know, lose their parents before they've had a chance to get them. So from my point of view, I've been very lucky that I've been able to know Dad for the last 35 years, which is wonderful, really.
I think we're successful because I think, it's a form of advice to those who are unfortunately in the same position as myself. If you want the breakup of a marriage to finish successfully, there has to be generosity on both sides. We now have an extended family now, and you couldn't be more proud of a family
than
that.
Which is great. And he does save your book reviews when you lose them on your computer.
Yes, that's right. He does. Thank goodness there were 140 reviews I'd lost. I was devastated.
And he found them for you.
Yes, he did.
But look, we're going to take the next piece of music, which you love, Richard. It is beautiful, but it's so sad. Why do you love it?
Well, as a kid, one of the things, I'm a night bird, so I'd stay up till 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. And again, because there was so little parental control, we'd be able to listen to music lying on the carpet at home. And my favourite musician was Leonard Cohen. I just found it inspiring.
Would you still go to see him now when he comes to Dublin?
I went to see him. My partner, Olga, brought me to see him as a special treat in Kilmainham. And he, at 70, I think he's 72 or 73, he's the most amazing character.
OK, let's listen now to Suzanne from Leonard Cohen.
Suzanne takes you down to her place near the river. You can hear the boats go by. You can spend the night beside her. And you know that she's half crazy.
It is a beautiful song, Leonard Cohen, Suzanne. You even liked that, Richard, didn't you?
Yes, I liked it. I don't like modern music, but that's very
modern music. Leonard would
60s.
Like that. Yeah, but
the lyric is so wonderful in it.
Yeah, it is beautiful. Yeah. In your case, Richard, you didn't go like your dad or your granddad into politics or medicine. You're an entrepreneur. Mind you, a very successful one.
Being the eldest in the family, there was a lot of pressure from the family that I should go into college. And I decided eventually to go into engineering. I had an uncle who was an engineer. It was the year of the strike in UCD, so I was in Earlsford Terrace and I lasted about 2 months. And rather than wasting dad's money, I left. And so, but I had started doing discos from the age of 15. And so I had developed an interest in business from an early age. So this absorbed my time. From the family point of view, they weren't very happy about, you know, their son as a DJ. And there was pressure on me to, since I left university, that I should at least get a proper job with a friend of theirs, a company called Hamilton Hamilton. They were auctioneers. And I remember my salary in working in Hamilton's was £10 a week for a 40-hour week. And then a Friday night in Wesley, I was getting paid £50. And a Saturday night in Leinster, I was getting paid £50. So I was getting £100 for 8 hours' work, and I was getting £10 for 40 hours' work. But I stuck it for a year just to prove that, you know, I had the capacity to do that. And then there was a mum and dad said, well, would you not consider going back to university? Try one more time. And so I said, OK. And I went to the NIHE, which at the time was set up by Ed Walsh in Limerick. Unfortunately, I didn't do very well there because I got elected as entertainment officer within 2 weeks of joining the college. And so my studies went downhill rapidly and again got involved in discos, lunchtime concerts, doing all sorts of things for the students' union. And so I came to a sticky end in Limerick when I introduced condoms to the Students' Union shop, which in those days, that was in 1973, the Legion of Mary reported me actually to the college. So I was told that I wasn't the most ideal candidate for the college. So I thought, took that as a hint to leave, and I left, and I have been in business ever since.
But it's nice that on the recent programme, The Secret Millionaire, you went back to Limerick.
I actually arrived on the first day of filming to Houston station, not knowing where I was going. And they had talked to me before the programme and had got a sense of where I had been at in my life. And they said, you're going to Limerick. And my first reaction, because I haven't been in Limerick in years, and there was always the perception about Limerick as, you know, being a city, being a rough city, being, you know, violent and everything like that. And I saw it as a challenge going down there, but it was an amazing experience. And Limerick really has it's a rough deal, you know, in mm-hmm. relation to the media, that the people in Limerick are just wonderful people.
And you got involved in some of the charities a lot.
There were some amazing charities. There was in particular a couple, Brendan and Terry Ring, their daughter died of a brain tumour. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people, when they lose a child, it's such a devastation and such a blow to their lives. You know, many marriages break up and people take to the drink. And Terry and Brendan just inspired me, because they were determined they were not going to let their daughter be forgotten. And they had seen so many other people who had very sick children that their parents couldn't afford to go to the hospital to see their child who was long-term sick in the hospital. So they set up this charity called the Cleanering Foundation, now Cleaners Foundation. And they raised money to give money to these families. They just write a check to a family that could help them so much in that terrible time of need. So that really inspired me. And I could never have given them enough money. I would never have had enough money to give them. But what I did want to do was to give my time. And I've spent the last 8 months working with them, and I hope to spend many more years working with them to help them.
Yeah, extraordinary couple. So you found quite a lot of poverty in Limerick, which I think surprised you. I mean, when you look back, I suppose, at the founding fathers of our state, which included your grandfather, do you think they'd be very dismayed when you still see that level of poverty?
They would be absolutely horrified to see what we have done to our country. There's a whole level of society that is completely under the radar. And I couldn't, I would think that I'm reasonably socially aware, until I went to Limerick and went to Weston, and I saw the poverty there, people, and I could not believe that in this day and age, in the Celtic Tiger, when we've wasted billions, that there could be people still caught up, second, third generation, unemployed, the council's making no effort to look after these people.
It's quite a wide poverty, a poverty of education, a poverty of insight, a poverty of social cohesion. I'm just paraphrasing what you're saying.
It was it's unbelievable to think that we have ignored these people. And, you know, I have a great admiration for people giving to charities abroad, but we have some incredible emotional and physical poverty in this country, and these people don't count.
What is Rishtard Mulcahy's secret? I'm sitting beside you, not just physically, but mentally. You're incredible for a man in his 90s. What's your secret?
No smoking, aerobic exercise.
Do you mean walking?
Walking, jogging, running, cycling, even doing the odd 26.2 mile
marathon.
Marathon, which I did on a few occasions. The other points are I eat everything, but only in moderation. I drink alcohol, but only in moderation. I think these are the important points.
You've left one out, Dad. I think you've left one important point out, and that's been married to a young wife.
Oh, well, that's an emotional point, really. But
who minds it very well.
Who minds it very well,
yes. Miriam is asking me about my age and my health.
What about your mental and intellectual well-being? Like, you're incredibly sharp.
Yeah, well, in the last 24 years since I retired, I've been keeping a careful diary of all the changes that aging are taking place. which I published in Kindle, there are two very important points why I should understand my aging. One is that if I get any symptoms of aging, I mustn't go to a doctor because I may finish up on the medical treadmill. The second thing is, if you understand the things that are happening to you as you're aging, is you adapt. You must adapt to them, and you must adapt a constructive, optimistic approach to them. So much so that when I get into the 90s now, I'm still as optimistic about my health and my future. And I know that I haven't very long to go, but it doesn't worry me in the slightest. It's been a wonderful life. And I think in some ways, the last 24 years have been the best time of my life.
Since you retired.
Yeah.
His optimism is probably catching because... Are you a positive, optimistic person or not?
Yeah, I would look at the glass being half full. So, okay.
Richard shares a lot of views with me, which makes me feel very good.
It's as easy to go through life being optimistic. In fact, it's easier than pessimistic. And I look at every single day as something is new and fresh.
Yes, the reason I mention this is I use the word challenge in my book on the Kindle. My challenge to aging, and that is what it is. Aging is a challenge, and a very interesting one.
Do you think you will go somewhere else when you leave this world?
No. I think I've done my bit, good or bad. I think I remind myself of the kind of beech leaf, which lasts about 6 or 7 months, contributes to the nutrition and to the well-being of the tree, and then passes them away quietly without any great regrets.
I'm not killing him off now, but have you thought of a time when you might not have your dad around?
Absolutely. But the important thing is that I've had him for so long, and we have shared so much, so that, you know, it'll be a celebration when he dies of what he's done.
He looks...
And he's to have a celebration afterwards.
A good one.
I left a little in my will for the champagne.
Oh, good man. Well, look, you've been a pleasure to have this morning. We're going into a lovely piece of music. You love Richard from Messiah, I Know My Redeemer Liveth.
I was so moved last Christmas when I was at the Messiah in the National Concert Hall. It was one. And we always, every year, we go up to the choir. Seeing the conductor facing you is wonderful. So I advise the next year, go to the choir. And I listen to this wonderful soprano.
I've never got that far. Always fell asleep after the first 10 minutes of the Messiah.
But you're going to go next Christmas with your father.
He has tried to drag me many times, but I'm afraid I won't go that far.
But look, it's been a pleasure having you both. So thank you very much for being my guest, Richard.
It's been a pleasure. A pleasure.
Thank you very much.
My thanks on sound today to Damien Chanel, to my producer Eileen Herron. We'll be here at the next time next Sunday. Thank you very much for listening. We're going out now listening to Messiah's I Know My Redeemer Liveth.
Miriam Meets on RTE Radio 1. Listen back or podcast at rte.ie/radioplayer.